We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Carol Spindell sitting in today for David Inge on Focus, our morning interview program on WILL AM 580, Illinois Public Media. The producer of the program is Harriet Williamson. At the controls today is Kyle Mabry. Our guest in this part of the program is novelist Julie Otsuka, and we are going to be talking about her second novel, The Buddha in the Attic, published by Knopf. It's written in a multiple, first-person, plural voice, so that we hear many voices of young Japanese women who come to America just after World War I to marry men they have never met. If you'd like to join our conversation with a comment or a question for our guest, please call in at 217-333-9455, or from farther away, you can use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Julie Otsuka, good morning, and welcome to Focus.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
This novel is like its namesake, the little Buddha statue that one woman leaves behind in her attic when she has to go to the internment camp. It's tiny but beautifully carved. And the voice of the novel is unusual. I think it's one of the few I have ever read written in the plural first person. So tell us about that. How did you come to have so many narrators?
Well, actually, I had tried to write to tell the story initially from the point of view of one picture bride, and it just felt kind of flat to me and not so interesting. And I was really kind of flailing around for several months trying to find the right voice, and I was looking through my notes, and I stumbled across this line that kind of popped at me, and it was the sentence, "On the boat we were mostly virgins," which is now the first line of the novel. And as soon as I saw that line that I'd written weeks before and forgotten about, I thought, aha, that would be a great first line for the book. And that was what gave me the idea to tell the story in the what I call the we voice. But it was really it was a very fun voice to write, and it allowed me to incorporate a lot of the stories that I ran across in my research.
It's interesting that despite the multiple plural we voice, individual women do appear out of this sort of braided thread, and their experience is very particular, like one sleeps with a sailor on the boat and then jumps overboard, one has a child that dies after a still explodes, only one leaves the Buddha in the attic. I mean, they really are individual experiences, and yet all these individual experiences are woven together into a multiple voice.
Right. I mean, I wanted to just give snippets, just little tiny windows into particular women's lives, but I don't follow any one particular thread all the way through the novel. And I use italicized lines of dialogue all throughout, just to give a sense of who somebody might be, but only just for a flash, only just for a moment.
Do you think this way of writing a story perhaps conveys the power of a shared culture and a shared generational experience more than an individual narrator would?
Yes, because, I mean, the Japanese, in particular, they're a very group-oriented culture. And, you know, it's considered poor form to promote your own needs above the needs of the group. And the experience that these women went through was a very common experience. So, in a couple senses, it made a lot of sense to use the first-person plural to tell their story.
Maybe I could ask you to read a few passages so that our radio listeners could have a sense of the voice and the style.
Oh, of course.
We were talking about maybe a couple of these on-the-boat passages in the early part of the book.
Right. The first chapter, it's set in the steerage compartment of a ship bringing a group of 100-plus young Japanese women to America. So they're very hopeful and dreamy and expectant, and they're looking forward to the good life in America. So here is one passage. "On the boat, we often stood on the deck for hours with the wind in our hair, watching the other passengers go by. We saw turbaned Sikhs from the Punjab who were fleeing to Panama from their native land. We saw wealthy white Russians who were fleeing the revolution. We saw Chinese laborers from Hong Kong who were going to work in the cotton fields of Peru. We saw King Lee Ivanovich and his famous band of gypsies who owned a large cattle ranch in Mexico and were rumored to be the richest band of gypsies in the world. We saw a trio of sunburned German tourists and a handsome Spanish priest and a tall, ruddy Englishman named Charles who appeared at the railing every afternoon at 3:15 and walked several brisk lengths of the deck. Charles was traveling in first class and had dark green eyes and a sharp, pointy nose and spoke perfect Japanese and was the first white person many of us had ever seen. He was a professor of foreign languages at the university in Osaka and had a Japanese wife and a child and had been to America many times and was endlessly patient with our questions. Was it true that Americans had a strong animal odor? Charles laughed and said, "Well, do I?" and let us lean in close for a sniff. "And just how hairy were they?" "About as hairy as I am," Charles replied, and then he rolled up his sleeves to show us his arms, which were covered with dark brown hairs that made us shiver. "And did they really grow hair on their chests?" Charles blushed and said he could not show us his chest, and we blushed and explained that we had not asked him to. "And were there still savage tribes of Red Indians wandering all over the prairies?" Charles told us that all the Red Indians had been taken away, and we breathed a sigh of relief. "And was it true that the women in America did not have to kneel down before their husbands or cover their mouths when they laughed?" Charles stared at a passing ship on the horizon and then sighed and said, "Sadly, yes." "And did the men and women there really dance cheek to cheek all night long?" "Only on Saturdays," Charles explained. "And were the dance steps very difficult?" Charles said they were easy and gave us a moonlit lesson on the foxtrot the following evening on the deck. "Slow, slow, quick, quick." "And was downtown San Francisco truly bigger than the Ginza?" "Why, of course." "And were the houses in America really three times the size of our own?" "Indeed, they were." "And did each house have a piano in the front parlor?" Charles said it was more like every other house. "And did he think we would be happy there?" Charles took off his glasses and looked down at us with his lovely green eyes and said, "Oh, yes, very." And then I'm going to skip to the very end of this chapter. On the boat, we could not have known that when we first saw our husbands, we would have no idea who they were. That the crowd of men in knit caps and shabby black coats waiting for us down below on the dock would bear no resemblance to the handsome young men in the photographs. That the photographs we had been sent were 20 years old. That the letters we had been written to us by people other than our husbands, professional people with beautiful handwriting whose job it was to tell lies and win hearts. That when we first heard our names being called out across the water, one of us would cover her eyes and turn away, "I want to go home." But the rest of us would lower our heads and smooth down the skirts of our kimonos and walk down the gangplank and step out into the still, warm day. "This is America," we would say to ourselves. "There is no need to worry." And we would be wrong.
Thank you so much for reading that.
You're welcome.
What a pleasure for me and for our listeners. Those passages really capture the sweetness and the sour, or the sweetness and the bitter, that are just constantly threaded through this book, almost in equal proportions often.
Yeah, I mean, their lives were not all suffering and hardship, although for many of them, life was very, very difficult. But I also, you know, I wanted to show moments of hope. My training is as a painter, so I wanted there to be bright spots of color throughout. Because in the end, I mean, these women did survive. They were very tough. And I think, in a way, you know, even though life for them didn't turn out so well, they pinned a lot of their hopes on their children. So they remained hopeful, I think, for a long time, until the outbreak of the war.
This book is only, we should talk about length. It's like a little jewel. It's only 129 pages long. And I was wondering if you were influenced by Japanese literary aesthetics like haiku or tanka or probably many others that I don't know about, where the form is, you know, very constrained and the content kind of fits inside it.
Right. No, actually, I think I'm probably most influenced by Ernest Hemingway, who's, I love the cadences of his sentences and how everything is pared down. And especially I'm thinking of the Nick Adams stories, you know, the trauma of that character is only, you know, very quietly hinted at, but not really spelled out.
Well, you're also part of a generation of writers who grew up with a certain level of technology as part of everyday life. And there seems to be a lot of discussion these days. Many people think we simply have shorter attention spans than previous generations because we're flooded with so much information and stimuli all the time. And do you think that has anything to do with your predilection for brevity? Or
I mean, I myself am very low-tech, so and actually I write every day in my neighborhood cafe, and there's no internet access there, no outlet, so you're really forced to focus on your work. But, I mean, I personally would like to write longer books, but for whatever reason they come out like this. I think I'm constantly revising and paring down as I'm working. But when I work, I really try to put myself in a distraction-free zone. But I think it's true. And in order to write, you really need to be able to sustain focus uninterrupted, I think, for a long period of time. And it does seem like that's hard to do these days.
It's true. You said that you painted before you wrote novels. And was there a relationship between the style of painting that you loved or that you practiced and the way you write?
Not necessarily the style, but I think in terms of practice and the discipline of just going to the studio every day and sketching out a scene on the canvas and bringing up the details very slowly relates very much to the practice of writing. I go every day to the cafe and I'll sketch out a scene, which would be a paragraph on the page, and bring up the details very slowly. So in that sense, I think that they are very related.
So it's that discipline, the discipline of the and the commitment to the work that really informs the writing from
and
the art.
Actually, I think this was pointed out to me after my first book was written. I wasn't aware of it, but I think that I think very visually, so I often have to see a scene in my head before I can begin to describe it on the page. I feel like the first book really came to me in pictures, but I feel like actually the new novel came more to me as song, as rhythm. I was constantly reading it out loud to myself as I was writing it, and I almost could hear the rhythm of the next sentence that I wanted to write before I knew the exact words to drop into that rhythmic pattern. So it was just this kind of incantatory chant that was kind of just pushing me through the novel. So it was a little bit different, I think, in its conception than the first book.
Well, both your novels are historical fiction, and so it's kind of an enterprise in which a writer of our time, filled, of course, with our way of viewing the world, and there you are sitting in the cafe in our world, you try to enter into and understand the feelings and the way of thinking of these people of an earlier generation. Or do you think that's too literal an understanding of what historical fiction is? Maybe it's really a book about what someone of today, you in this case, the way in which you can make sense of that generation's understanding of the past.
I mean, yeah, I think I would agree. Especially my first novel, I think I wrote it not to tell a story that I felt like the world needed to hear, but really for me to try and make sense of my own mother's life. She was interned as a young girl when she was 10. She was living in Berkeley when she was uprooted and sent to the camps, and her father was arrested by the FBI a day after Pearl Harbor was bombed as a suspected spy for Japan. So, and I didn't really know very much about what had happened to her during the war as a child growing up. And when I began to write my novel, I think it was a way of her daughter, you know, trying to understand what it was that, you know, that my mother had gone through. And I think for my new book, I think I've always been just very interested in the lives of women. And I feel like the picture board story is actually a very common first-generation story. Thousands of people's grandmothers came over as picture brides. And actually, when I was on tour for my first book, I would often talk to people in the audiences after I would give a reading, and they would tell me that their grandmothers came over as a picture bride. Actually, I did a reading in Pasadena on Monday night, and three people came up in the audience afterwards and said that their grandmothers had come over as picture brides. And one woman said that her grandmother had expected to marry a very wealthy businessman, and her husband turned out to be an itinerant carnival worker, and life was very difficult for her. So I think my project, and in a sense, I wanted to give these women a voice, and even though their story is a common one, I feel like we haven't really heard it.
Right. I was trying to picture the sort of mechanics of this. Obviously, there's someone in California, and they're corresponding with someone in Japan who is, they receive the photos, and then they go and speak with families and who have daughters.
Yeah, there was often a matchmaker involved who would arrange for, I mean, the problem for the Japanese immigrant men in California in the early 1900s was that by law they could not marry a white woman. If you were a white woman and you married a Japanese man, a Japanese immigrant man, you would lose your citizenship. So these men had no women to marry. So they would arrange through a matchmaker to have a bride sent over. And so the men and women would exchange letters and photographs. But often the letters were lies and the photographs, you know, had been doctored.
It's not the same thing that's happening on the internet
today. I know, except for it's like a, back then
it's like an early version.
Exactly. It's like an internet date for life that you cannot back out of.
I mean, oh, my gosh.
There's no going back for this young
oh,
girl.
No. Let me just say that this is guest host Carol Spindell, and you're listening to Focus. We're speaking today with Julie Otsuka about her book, The Buddha in the Attic. And if you would like to join our conversation with a comment or a question for our guest, we'd love to have you join us. So call us at 217-333-9455 or at 1-800-222-9455 or email us in your comment or your question at will-talk@illinois.edu. So we hope you'll do that. All right. Well, you obviously did a huge amount of research for this book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, I did so much. Because I really had to learn about two worlds, about the old rural Japan from which these girls came, and then America in the 20s and 30s. And I didn't start out knowing very much about picture brides at all, but I kept many, many notebooks just filled with factoids about every aspect of their lives. I had to learn about migrant farm life, because often 3 or 4 days after landing in America, these girls, instead of living the good life in America, they heard about the streets paved with gold, but they were often picking lettuce or tomatoes in the fields and living in migrant labor camps. Or if they ended up in the cities or the suburbs, they were working as maids for white women. So I had to learn about country life and city life. And I did a lot of research. I love reading oral histories. And so I read many collections of oral histories and history books, and I also looked at old newspapers. And what I found particularly interesting were there's something called the shipping list. So often, back in the 1910s and 20s, when a ship pulled into port, it was a huge event. So they would announce the passengers, or list the passengers in the newspaper who were on the boat, and it was just very, very interesting. You know, I probably used maybe 2% of my research, but I just feel like for my own sake, in order to confidently tell the story well, I had to do my homework. So I was extremely thorough before I began to write. I really tried to learn as much as I could about their lives.
Well, is that the first part of the process for you? Or do you start writing and then go back to these oral histories?
I go back and I can't just research because I'll go crazy. I mean, I always need to be writing. Initially, in the first year or two, I'm probably my day is more heavily weighted towards the research process, but I always try to write a little bit every day.
Now, obviously, your childhood was spent around people. You grew up, I believe, in California in the Japanese-American community, and many of the adults around you must have been in the internment camps.
But they didn't talk about it.
They didn't.
Again, it's a generational thing. I mean, my mother, my aunt and uncle, my grandparents. I was fairly young when my grandfather died, but I didn't know anything at all about, what he'd gone through during the war. And I remember we were moving my grandmother out of the house that she lived in for years and into a residence for the elderly. And on the last day that she was in that house, my aunt and uncle were cleaning out my grandmother's fireplace, and they found a box of letters in the fireplace that my grandmother wanted to burn. And they were letters that her husband had sent to her during the first year of the war from the camps where he was detained, to her and the children in the camps where they were being held. And, you know, nobody knew the existence of these letters. And, you know, when I read them, I was just amazed. It was like a story, but I didn't know anything about what he'd gone through. And I think many of the Japanese were just very reticent about their experience. I think also they didn't really want to impart a sense of bitterness to their children.
Mm.
And in a way, I'm grateful for that. I mean, I grew up feeling fairly safe in America and that I could do whatever I wanted to do. So I can understand why they were silent for so long. I think more of them are speaking now that they're reaching the end, you know, the end of their lives.
Right.
It's more
right.
urgent that these stories be told.
Did your grandfather write those letters in English?
He actually did, because you would have a faster time of getting past the censors if you wrote in English. If you wrote in Japanese, it would take much longer because they would have to translate from Japanese to English for the censors. So every single letter that went, you know, that left his hand was censored by the FBI.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Well, you know, I have to say I didn't realize to what extent families were separated in these camps, because in the pictures we see, or in maybe some of the children's books I had read, you know, the family goes together to a camp. And I didn't realize that the men were kind of singled out first.
Well, only particular men who were considered to be security risks were singled out. So it was probably less than 10% of the male population. So you're right in that most families actually were able to remain together. But the FBI had a list of men that they targeted. They knew that if America were attacked, that these were the men that they would go and arrest. They were men that had been under surveillance for at least a year by the FBI before the outbreak of the war.
In your book, there's someone who is suspected because they own a Japanese flute or play a Japanese flute.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could be arrested for, you know, for owning a photograph, well, of the emperor, or, you know, of having something like a toy bamboo flute. So, which is why right after the outbreak of World War II, all the Japanese families just began burning and getting rid of all of anything that was just even remotely Japanese, or just all of their letters, photographs, objects, chopsticks, anything they just tried to get rid of.
And the other thing I hadn't realized when I looked at the chronology of how quickly this happened, December 7th, Pearl Harbor was attacked. December 8th, the United States Treasury Department seized all Japanese banks and businesses.
Yes. So it was very hard. I remember I know that my grandmother had trouble getting money out of the bank for a few months, and then some of the restrictions were lifted, but I also remember my grandmother telling me that she and her husband was a businessman in San Francisco. He worked for an import-export company, but they also had started a business on the side. They were brewing soy sauce, which takes about a year to ferment. So they had set this up in a factory, and it was seized by the government. And they had invested about $10,000, and I think they got a check for about $400 after the war for the business. So I don't know what kind of security threat soy sauce would pose, but their assets were definitely seized. And for most of these families, I mean, they were really bankrupted by the war. I mean, they you know, everything they had worked so hard for decades just came to naught in the end.
It's really a large number of people, too. When we think about it, I usually see the number 120,000
yeah.
Japanese Americans. I mean, to imagine just forcing 120,000 people to pick up and relocate so quickly.
Yeah, logistically, it was kind of amazing. And the Japanese, I mean, you know, I'm often asked, well, why didn't they protest? And, you know, I mean, what do you do if somebody's, you know, holding a gun to your head and saying, go, you just go? And but it was kind of an amazing feat. I mean, these camps were built very, very quickly in very remote areas of the country, often in the desert, and they were shipped out there.
We're going to take a brief break here. This is Carol Spindell sitting in for David Inge. You're listening to Focus, and we'll be right back very shortly with our guest, Julie Otsuka.
WILL programs are made possible by Sinfonia da Camera, presenting B is for Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms on Saturday, September 17th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert. Fred Stolzfus leads the U of I Chorale in Bach's Magnificat. More information is available at 333-6280.
Now, many of us reading your book and thinking about the war and the internment, we can't help but think about the fear and confusion Americans felt after 9/11 and the way that fear and confusion can quite easily be manipulated. Was that in your mind as you wrote the book, or were you very much thinking of one particular era in time and one particular experience?
Well, actually, my first novel really addresses, you know, the Japanese being the other after Pearl Harbor was bombed, which I think is very similar to the Muslims and Arabs in this country suddenly being targeted as the enemy after 9/11. But I finished my first novel in June of 2001, so it was before 9/11. So I had no idea it would reverberate in the way that it has. And so writing my new novel, I did write that with the knowledge of 9/11 and what had happened, in the back of my mind always. So you can't really unknow that.
That's right, and that's why I think it's interesting, the whole concept of writing historical fiction, because you can't be those people. You have to be yourself reflecting on those people's experience. It's inevitable.
Yes. No, I agree. I agree.
When I was looking, after I finished your book, I looked at the chronology, as I said, of the timeline of the this experience, this what we usually call now this shameful chapter in American history. And I was very struck by the phrases in the 1983 statement that this was not justified by military necessity, and the decisions to do this internment, this relocation, were based on race prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership.
Yes, the Japanese Americans on the West Coast they had been investigated prior to the outbreak of the war, and the government knew that they did not pose a security risk. Yes, there was a great deal of fear. People were afraid that Japan would attack, and yet there was really no evidence at all that the Japanese Americans were disloyal. I think there were economic reasons also for their imprisonment. Many of them, the farmers especially, had taken land that was really useless and made it extremely productive, and so their land was coveted by many white farmers. I think that there was very little opposition to their leaving. I think there was, most of the citizens living on the West Coast wanted their neighbors gone, and would be happy to see them leave.
You know, I've been talking about the we voice in your book, and we heard you read from one of the wee voices, but there's actually a second wee voice that comes in at the end of the book, and we really should talk about that, because we do hear the voices of the white neighbors of the Japanese Americans after they're gone.
Yes, and the last chapter, I feel like, came out, it was a piece of unfinished business from my first novel. When I was on tour for the first book, I would sometimes run into people in California, often, who've been alive during World War II, and they would tell me, I knew nothing, about the Japanese being sent away, and I would think, really, how could you not know that? Didn't you notice that your neighbors were disappearing, or didn't you see the evacuation order notices on the telephones? Because they were really plastered everywhere. So there seemed to be this collective amnesia that I was running across. So I just wondered, what would it be like to be a white person in a town the moment after your Japanese neighbors have left, and how would you process that? And so that was how I got the idea for the very, very last chapter.
Well, maybe we should let listeners hear just a little bit of that wee voice so they can hear the contrast. What do you think?
Oh, sure.
That would be a good idea.
Yeah, let me see. Okay, let me read a passage.
That chapter, I'll just tell them while you're looking,
okay,
is entitled A Disappearance. And while you're looking there, let me just remind our listeners, too, if you want to join us, please call in. This is Carol Spindell, and I'm your guest host today on Focus. You can call us at 217-333-9455 or at 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu and send us your questions or your comments for Julie Otsuka. We'd love to hear from you.
Okay, I found a good passage to read. It's so the we voice in this last chapter is we, the white townspeople. And these are neighbors kind of reflecting on what's happened to their Japanese neighbors' pets. We begin to receive reports of lights left on in some of the Japanese houses and animals in distress. A listless canary glimpsed through the Fujimoto's front window, dying koi in a pond over at the Yamaguchi's, and everywhere the dogs. We offer them bowls of water, pieces of bread, leftover scraps from our tables. The butcher sends over a fresh cut of filet mignon. The Koyama's dog sniffs politely and then turns away. The Ueda's dog bolts past us, and before we can stop her, she's out the front gate. The Nakanishi's dog, a Scottish terrier that is a dead ringer for the president's little black dog, Fala, bares his teeth and won't let us anywhere near. But the rest come running out to greet us as though they have always known us and then follow us home. And within days, we have found them new owners. When family says they would be more than happy to adopt a Japanese dog, another asks if there are any collies. The wife of a young soldier who was just called up for duty takes home the Maruyama's black and tan beagle, Duke, who follows her from room to room and won't let her out of his sight. He's my protector now, she says. We get along just fine. Sometimes, though, in the middle of the night, she can hear him whimpering in his sleep, and she wonders if he is dreaming of them.
Thank you. So there's a very different voice.
It is a very different wee voice, and I think I knew when I began the novel that I wanted to flip it at the very end to this wee voice, and I think there are varying responses to how well this ending works, but it was really important to me that I get this last wee voice into the book.
The voice that just the people who just don't see, the other people have, the women, when they narrate their stories, they see so clearly, and they always have these telling little details about their children or about their husbands or about the farm work. And then these people either just see and kind of shake their heads in bewilderment or don't see at all.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want it to be a completely negative portrayal of them because mm-hmm. I remember speaking to one woman who was in the first grade during the war, when the war broke out. And she said, her classmate was a Japanese girl who always sat right next to her. And she said, you know, one day she was there and the next day she was gone. And she said, I never knew what happened to her. And so I wondered, you know, how did that white girl's parents explain to her the disappearance of her classmate? So I wanted it to be also a sympathetic portrait. I mean, mm-hmm. I was especially interested actually in the lives of children and how they would process the disappearance of their classmates. And because, you know, there were some good whites there who were good neighbors to their Japanese neighbors, who let their Japanese neighbors store things, store mm-hmm. their belongings mm-hmm. In their attics, in their basements. So, you know, there were many different reactions to the Japanese going away. Many people, I think, maybe, perhaps they really just didn't know, although I found it, you know, I find that hard to believe, but the Japanese also lived in segregated neighborhoods, so you could live in an all-white neighborhood and have nothing to do with the Japanese and maybe not know what was going on with them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I wanted it to be a fair portrait as well of the town.
Okay, well, listen, we have someone on line one. They're calling in from Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to just add into the stuff today. When I was in high school, we had a warmonger speaker for an assembly, and we had a very beloved teacher who had taught for years in Kyoto before coming to the States and teaching, and she was an American. And there were about three dozen of us who got up in the assembly and walked out.
Mm.
It was so revolting to us. So there were some of us who saw what was happening and understood. I just wanted to tip.
And where was that in the United States?
It was in Syracuse, New York.
Uh-huh. And was your teacher there in the assembly?
Yes, she was.
She was.
She was asked to leave by the principal. Oh. And when she walked out, we walked out with her.
I see.
I was just shocked. I was a junior in high school.
Well, it's a very, very brave act, though, just to walk out like that. Yeah, and it's so good to hear stories like that, too, from me, personally.
Well,
it's good to hear that, you know. I need to hear about those.
The teacher was not disciplined, nor were we.
Uh-huh, interesting.
Which I felt, looking back on it, was very broad-minded of the administration. But I just wanted to add that to your very interesting program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in with your story. Isn't it always true, Julia, that it's these particular stories that make the history come alive, that make us really understand what was happening?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I feel like that's, you know, I'm fortunate in that way, and that I've gotten to travel and I've spoken to many people who were around then. And to me, it's very heartening to hear stories like that. I think we need to hear more of them.
That's right. That's right. Somehow we don't understand when we hear these abstract terms. And, of course, you as a writer think in very specific details and have plucked them out and linked them together. And that's really what makes reading this book such a pleasure, these little specific details. I was struck by a lot of the details, too, of farm life in that era, the way these women lived in the country. Many of them seemed to have no homes. They were just moving from place to place.
No, they didn't. I mean, many of them lived in these huge migrant labor camps. And it was also difficult to have a home because Japanese immigrants, by law, were prevented from owning property. So they couldn't buy a house. And then after a while, there were what were called the alien land laws. So they could only lease or rent for X number of years, maybe 3 years at the most. So they were constantly on the move. And they were working so hard, and they made very little money, especially if they were working in a labor camp or tenant farmers. So, you know, I think life was probably in many ways more difficult than the lives that they would have led if they had stayed in Japan.
Right, right. And, of course, I'm sure many of the characters in your book are farmers, and they live very hard lives. They're very poor. Of course, we know there were also middle-class and upper-class Japanese-Americans who owned businesses and so on. But I was struck by so many images of them sleeping in the orchards, for example, under the trees they were there to pick.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing to me now to think about, you know, just how hard their lives were. And you think of Japanese women as being, you know, very petite and demure, but these were tough pioneer women who used their bodies for years and often wore out their bodies, you know. But they were working that land.
That's, you know, it's interesting because I also thought about that. They're small bones, and there they are doing farm labor and bearing children at the same time. And that's a very tough life physically, and yet these women were tough.
Yeah, they were. There's actually a term that it's called double harness. I mean, these women worked all day long in the fields, and then when they got home, the husbands were very Japanese, and so the husbands would just relax, but the women had to do the cooking and, you know, take care of the kids when they got home. So they really had, you know, two full-time jobs or lives going on. Well, the men actually got to rest at the end of the day.
Well, and that's why they say women's work is never done.
Uh-huh.
They didn't make that up. But do you think that that experience changed? Did they mother their daughters differently than they were mothered, do you think? And then you were, something was passed on to you?
I think they were very, very tough mothers to their children, and they expected a lot. I think, you know, being the child of someone like that, you would feel a sense of guilt also at how much your mother and your father had sacrificed to give you a good life. So expectations, I think, were high for the children of that generation because their parents were really a sacrifice generation. They had kind of given up. They have given up their own lives, you know, because there was really, I think, for these women, there was no way that they were going to really be able to achieve anything given the circumstances in America and the limitations on their own lives. But for their children, I think they had high hopes, and I think it was difficult in a way to be a child of those immigrants.
And do you see a high rate of excellence, of people determined to accomplish a great deal and to excel among their children?
I had out lunch with my cousins yesterday, and we were talking about that. Oh, definitely. I mean, I think in Japanese culture, you are expected to do extremely well if you're a second or third generation Japanese. There's a lot of pressure, I think, that we feel on some level to do good by our parents.
Do you think that Japanese Americans, when they hear you read or when they read your book, what do they say? Are they pleased that these stories are coming out into the light of day?
I think that they are. I don't know why more fiction has not been written by more Japanese Americans about World War II or about the years leading up to it. But a lot of people that I've spoken to are glad that these stories are finally coming to light and also starting to speak to their own parents, because I think often we wait till it's a little bit too late before we know the right questions to ask. I know that with my own mother, when I started writing my first novel, I thought I'd be able to mine her for information about what she remembers about what she calls camp, but she was already then in the early phases of dementia. So I always tell people, ask your questions now. I mean, your parents, they've lived entire lives. There's so much that's there that's valuable, but don't wait until it's too late.
That's very sad. So just as you were writing the story that you wanted to write to make sense of her experience, she was losing that experience.
She was beginning to forget. But it was interesting. In the early phases of her dementia, she would begin to tell certain stories over and over again, mm-hmm. but some of them were stories that we'd never heard. And one story that she began to tell one day was about her last day at school in the world before she was sent away to camp. And she was in the fifth grade at Lincoln Elementary School in Berkeley. And her teacher asked my mother, Alice was her name, to stand up and then announce to the class that Alice would no longer be with them, and then had everyone say goodbye to her one by one. And my mother just said over and over again, she said, I was so embarrassed. I think she felt ashamed at being singled out.
And the teacher probably thought she was doing a kindness acknowledgement of that.
Yeah, I think it was a gesture of goodwill, just to say goodbye. I don't think
right.
it meant to humiliate my mother, and I'd never heard my mother tell this story, but for whatever reason, she began to tell it many, many times a day.
Interesting. And did your mother know about your first book?
She did. By the time it was finished, she couldn't really read, but she did know about the first book. And actually, I just visited her in the nursing home this last weekend when I was in L.A., and she hasn't spoken for a couple years. But I brought my new book to her, and I wore a name tag, my name Julie on a name tag. And she turned to the book flap at the end, and she looked at the photograph of me, and I think she could actually process, she could read my name, and then she looked at my name below, and then she looked at my name tag that said Julie, and then she looked at my face, and she kind of smiled, and she just did that over and over and over again. So I think on some level she realizes that I've written a new book as well.
It sounds like she really does.
Yeah.
Sometimes maybe being able to put something into words doesn't mean you don't know it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it is important as a writer, and it is important for our sort of communal historical record that we write. I think so often American history has been written without these stories.
Yeah, and often, at first I was very surprised, but often, I'm on the road a lot talking to young, high school students or college students, and some of them had never heard about the internment of the Japanese Americans. And I was at first I was shocked, but now I'm kind of used to it. But I think it's still really not in the history textbooks, in the U.S. history textbooks. So I think in a lot of ways it's a shameful and forgotten story.
Yeah, I think we could do, obviously, a much better job of teaching high school history. And those of us who care about the record and those of us who want to read these stories like the one you've written, I think we have to remain committed to that, to seeing that that happens.
It's important, I think, for us to remember our mistakes, even if that's difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought it was interesting when I was listening to you read the passages you read aloud to us. I thought, aha, there's two little warnings in these passages. And I don't know if I caught the first one the first time I read the book, but there's the question the lovely young women ask Charles about, oh, but we're frightened about the Red Indians. And he says, oh, don't worry, the Red Indians have all been taken away. And that phrase, taken away, now that I've read the whole book, when you read it, it just sort of chill went over me. Taken away, yes, they were.
And they don't know what that means.
No.
Yeah, and they don't know what life has in store for them.
But it shows how also we don't learn. When I was, as I said, after I finished your book, I wanted to read more about the historical events, and I was online reading and was interested to see that more and more monuments are being put up. For example, this one recent one on Bainbridge Island to commemorate the day that people were forced to leave their homes.
Oh, that's great. Actually, I'll be doing a reading on Bainbridge Island next week, so I didn't know about that. But I know that the first Japanese who were rounded up, evacuation order number one, was issued on that island. And I know that Topaz, Utah, which is where my mother was sent with her mother and her brother to spend the war years, I think has recently been declared a National Historic Monument. Which is important. I think it's really important that these spaces, remain and that people know what happened there.
That's right. There's something that you get from visiting a space and understanding its history that you can never, unfortunately, quite get out of a book. It's as powerful as a book can be.
Yeah. I remember actually visiting. I didn't want to visit the site of the camp until I finished writing my first novel. I just wanted to imagine it in my head, but I went out afterwards and I visited the site of the camp, and it was just kind of a stunning, bleak landscape, but you could still see the foundations of the barracks, concrete foundations of the barracks, and the original barbed wire fence was still there, which seemed very odd to me, but I guess in the desert, things are preserved for years because it's such a dry climate. You could see the ground was littered with shards of crockery and rusty nails, and so you could tell that at one point many, many people had lived there.
Mm, sort of a desert archaeology from the recent past. Well, do you think that there will be people there to interpret for people who come to explain? Is that part of the intention?
I think there is a museum in a nearby town, the town closest to the camp.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, I think that's definitely the intention, just to keep this history alive and let the story be told.
Well, it's an important story, and we need to learn from it as we think about the future and how we respond to fear. I was also reading, when I wanted to learn more, an article by Eleanor Roosevelt, who's someone so many of us admire, and she seemed to be kind of defending the camps against critics who were saying that, oh, the Japanese Americans are being treated too well.
Yeah, I mean, some people, she was defending the camps.
She was not saying that people shouldn't be in these camps in this article, but she was saying they're certainly not living a luxurious life here. And let me assure you, I've gone there and I've spent a day. And
yeah, I think her stance was quite different from that of her husband.
Yeah, I was struck by the fact that she did go and spend an entire day in one of the camps. And there was a photograph of her speaking with women who I assume were some sort of committee and being welcomed by women. And I thought of, and I had already, I still had your women's voices in my head as I looked at that photograph and thought, ah, here they are, and here's their chance, and I bet they're speaking up and talking to her. I hope they are.
Me too, although, most of them, their English never did get to, their English, they were never too proficient, so, I don't know how much they could actually say.
But, well, when you think of your book, we have a few more moments here to talk, and then we have to bring the conversation to a close. When you think of your book, you said that you're a very visual thinker. How do you picture it? Do you picture it like a large painting or a small drawing or a scroll, or how do you picture it?
Oh, that's a good question. I actually think I would picture it maybe as a long horizontal scroll with just different scenes, one after the other. which is not the way I painted. I mean, I would, you know, always paint on large canvases. It was just one large picture. But I feel like this book is made up of just many, many different vignettes, many, many different pictures that you know, that unscroll one after the other.
Well, I hope that maybe if this scroll is rolled up, another one will be opened and we'll have another book to read in the future. Have you started a new book?
I have. I don't know exactly if it's a novel, if it's stories, but it has something to do with dementia, forgetting, remembering, and also, I know this sounds kind of strange, but swimming in the life of the pool.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait, obviously, to learn more about that. So we're going to have to bring this conversation to a close. I'd like to thank our listeners for listening to Focus today. This is Carol Spindell, and I've been sitting in for David Inge. I'd especially like to thank that caller who called in with her story, too. Thank you so much for joining our conversation, and I think that was wonderful to hear that story. And I'd like to say that if you haven't read The Buddha in the Attic by Julie Otsuka, it's published by Knopf, and I'm sure you can find it at your local public library or your local bookseller. Julie Otsuka, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Carol.
Moments here to talk, and then we have to bring the conversation to a close. When you think of your book, you said that you're a very visual thinker. How do you picture it? Do you picture it like a large painting or a small drawing or a scroll? Or how do you picture it?
Oh, that's a good question. I actually think I would picture it maybe as a long horizontal scroll with just different scenes, one after the other, which is not the way I painted. I mean, I would, you know, always paint on large canvases. It was just one large picture. But I feel like this book is made up of just many, many different vignettes, many, many different pictures that you know, that unscroll one after the other.
Well, I hope that maybe if this scroll is rolled up, another one will be opened and we'll have another book to read in the future. Have you started a new book?
I have. I don't know exactly if it's a novel, if it's stories, but it has something to do with dementia, forgetting, remembering, and also, I know this sounds kind of strange, but swimming in the life of the pool.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait, obviously, to learn more about that. So we're going to have to bring this conversation to a close. I'd like to thank our listeners for listening to Focus today. This is Carol Spindell, and I've been sitting in for David Inge. I'd especially like to thank that caller who called in with her story, too. Thank you so much for joining our conversation, and I think that was wonderful to hear that story. And I'd like to say that if you haven't read The Buddha in the Attic by Julie Otsuka, it's published by Knopf, and I'm sure you can find it at your local public library or your local bookseller. Julie Otsuka, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Carol.
MSNBC has a new addition to its lineup, Al Sharpton. It's given the Reverend the larger pulpit he says he needs to voice his politics.
You can do that with a bullhorn on the corner at Washington Square Park, but that's not going to compete with a Rush Limbaugh or a Bill O'Reilly.
MSNBC's Gamble on Al Sharpton today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. Stuart Peterson develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information at stuart-peterson.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Chicago Board of Trade soybean futures are falling down to their session lows. They're weighed down by a weaker crude oil market today, as well as a strengthening dollar. Meanwhile, the corn trade today has been a choppy two-sided affair. The day started off in positive territory, but it certainly has drifted lower under the opening bell numbers today. And they're pairing the early gains in the spot and dipping below $7 a bushel. And that happening for the first time since August the 19th. So let's go ahead and look at some particulars. We'll begin over in Kansas City, where December wheat is trading 788 down 7 1/4. The May at 808 and a half down 8. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is trading at 694 down 2.